Welcome, everyone. This is Forrest for our final podcast talking about Pathways to Pain Relief, the first TMS book written by Dr. Sarno's most trusted psychotherapists. It's been a really exciting book to read, and certainly one that I think we've gained a lot of insights from. Many of us, or one often hears in the online TMS community, wouldn't it be wonderful if I had a chance to work with Dr. Sarno, and here's an opportunity to read some of the most important thoughts by some of the psychologists that he trusts the most and that he's worked with over the years to develop his own beliefs. So today, we're going to be wrapping things up. We're going to be talking about our personal experiences of either listening to and participating in these podcasts, what we've learned from it, and also what we've learned from reading it, if we have read it. Not everyone here necessarily has read it, but if you've listened to the podcasts and what you've heard has helped you, we'd love to hear about that as well. So we were talking about it beforehand, and we thought perhaps the best way to do this was just to go around to whomever wants to speak and just have each individual person share what they've learned, and then possibly after, you know, other people can jump in and we'll just see what sort of a discussion arises. Shall we start?
Okay.
All right. Would like who would like to go first? I have a bunch of ideas, but I figured I could go last since, or you know, closer to the end, let someone else open things up.
Well, I noticed in reading the conclusion to Sherman and Anderson's Pathways to Pain Relief, the word she uses, affect intolerance. And I think what I learned from reading their book was it deepened my understanding of how passive intellectual appreciation of the TMS process is not enough in order to affect a cure. What it really requires is fully experiencing a repressed emotion to overcome that affect intolerance she talks about. In her conclusion, she says, when the explicit connection between disavowed affect and pain symptomology is not systematically demonstrated to people, this dynamic remains on the fringes of their awareness. It does not become integrated as a permanent internal resource. Consequently, intolerance of one's own anger is never identified as the direct cause of the pain. And that's what she calls affect intolerance. And if I could bring up her postscript, I don't think I'll go into the particulars, but I noticed one idea that she advances is at the beginning of psychotherapy, each of my six patients had difficulty knowing what their feelings were. In fact, they had learned not to feel and to suppress feelings in order to survive challenging life circumstances. And then she goes on to list all of them, bullying by a sibling, witnessing accidents, living with a spouse who was emotionally and physically threatening Ellen, and so on. And it wasn't until these people, these patients, could feel the underlying rage. And I noticed in my own experience this week, I encountered this when I was doing three of Howard Schubner's meditations in this sequence. I think it starts mindfulness, stressors, and then a new you. Of course, I'd always known about my father belittling me and the low self-esteem and the compensatory mechanism, and I had it all charted out. However, I just happened to take the stressors meditation and started thinking about what was going on socially at the same time. how all of us kids were being bused to intermediate school and in seventh grade. Our working class neighborhood didn't fit into the paradigm of the local school structure. So we were kind of like oddballs. And in seventh grade, they bussed us over to Parkside Intermediate School, seventh grade. And the trips over there were like exercises in bullying, because all of the kids had been held back, who were like 16 years old still in seventh grade, would beat the heck out of all of the kids who were 12 and 11. And so the rides over there were reigns of terror, where I learned to take it. But I felt that for the first time, and all heck broke loose all week. And the bullying voice rose up, the one that I'd slayed, the one that I'd gotten rid of, and it started yelling at me day after day. And I realized, oh, you touched on it. This was not flat affect. That was what you were really feeling while your father was browbeating you. And it was a social, psychological situation that really amplified the situation in the home. And
can I interrupt a second? Or no?
Sure, yeah, go for it. Is this
and
Barbara?
I think that's what I got out of Anderson and Sherman.
Okay. This is Lynn. I haven't been with you for a while, but I've been listening to you, and I've been working with my psychotherapist, and I'm at the point that I realize I have all this rage, and I can't, and you made the point about knowing about it isn't enough, which is true. I know about all my rage, and I go out there with a hammer, and I hammer, and I do all kinds of things to get rid of the stress and the rage in my system, but it's not enough, because I really haven't felt the rage for all the trauma that I've been through, a tremendous amount of trauma, but I'm not going to go through that now, but... how do you feel? How do you get in touch? And my psychotherapist the last time I met with him, he didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to tell me to do. I don't know how to get in touch with to be able to actually feel all that rage. Do you take one incident at a time? Or do you take it all? You can't take it all. I don't think you could take it all at once. And I'm like at a crossroads, and I haven't gotten any. Actually, I've gotten worse. I have migraine headaches, and I fall, and I'm dizzy, and I lost two teeth last week.
Oh no!
Yeah.
And then
it's because I'm holding all this crap inside my body, and I don't know how to get it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I hear you on that. And well, one thing we should say is that, you know, we speak only, as kind of a book group, we speak only from our own experience. But as I think about what I got from the book, I liked the term affect tolerance. That it's learning how to me, what they're talking about is very much like mindfulness. Now, obviously, different people have different interpretations, but it's the ability to be mindful of an emotion and to allow yourself to feel that emotion in your body. You know, when you get angry, you can take a moment to feel the anger in your body. Where does it show up? Do you feel it in your gut? Do you feel it in your chest?
I feel it sometimes in my, it moves around. Sometimes in my gut, mostly in my shoulders, and most recently in my head. And my psychotherapist said, just to make sure, go to a neurologist to make sure there's not anything else going on. And then Tuesday night, for no reason, two teeth fell out and broke while I was eating. And I've always had a perfect mouth. I've never had any tooth problems.
Yeah.
So, and I know that was tension. I know it was, but I don't know how to, I can feel the tension and I know where it is in my body, but I can't figure out what's causing, a lot of times I can't figure out what particular thing is causing subconsciously the tension, and I don't know how to get rid of it.
So it sounds like the model that you're working with is it's on your shoulders. It's kind of a lot of responsibility that you're feeling. I need to figure it out. I need to figure it out, and when I figure it out, I can solve it. And I need to solve it now. My thought is that might not happen to some degree. That, you know, these emotions have been stored in your body and in your brain for a long time. And I think the word affect tolerance is telling in that in the short term, I think that making peace with the emotions might be a healthy step forward to say, okay, I feel this rage and I hate this rage. I hate this rage because it causes me pain. It causes me physical problems, but I can live with it. And, you know, I can tolerate this emotion. I don't have to do anything with this emotion. You know, it's there and I've dealt with it and I can deal with it and I can keep going forward. So, you know, it's not going to go away necessarily. I have good support. You know, I'm working with a therapist. I'm really glad you are because, you know, you got a lot going on. But to allow that and to live with it, I think is a valuable skill and, you know, give it some time. I find that a lot of these psychological challenges are much like mindfulness meditation.
Yes.
It's when you're working so hard to fix them, then that it's like you're feeding them energy. It's like you're inflating the problems. And once you can kind of step back, Alan Gordon, in one of his essays, calls this outcome independence, or it's at least a similar idea. Once you can step back and say, I know I am angry, I can feel it in my body, and now I'm going to move on. I'm going to focus on my garden. I'm going to focus on an interesting book. I'm going to focus just on taking a walk and feeling the ground beneath my feet. And you won't be able to completely.
I've been doing that. That's what I've been doing. I've been escaping and focusing on the present, but the rage hasn't gone. It hasn't gone away.
Yeah. Okay. So it's interesting what you're saying there, though. Is you're saying I've been doing it. Why hasn't the rage gone away? But when you say I've been doing it, and it sounds to me like you're saying I've been doing it, but it's not been working because the rage hasn't been going away. That feels like, well, there's still a little bit of outcome independence to work on. Like you're saying, the rage hasn't gone away yet. Why hasn't it gone away yet? And I'm getting angry that the rage hasn't gone away, and I'm getting frustrated, and I'm getting scared, and I'm getting all revved up and tense.
I know.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. You can hear it in your voice. But I think that the best thing to do is just to say, you know, the rage is there and the rage for a little while will be my companion. And that's okay. And I'm not going to take walks to feel the ground beneath my feet because it gets rid of the rage, because I think that's maybe not respecting the rage enough, that the rage will be there for a while. Instead, I'm going to take walks because taking walks feels good. And it feels a lot better than getting frustrated about the things I can't change. That would be my advice, at least. That's what I find works for me.
I think the point is, though, that you don't need to get rid of the rage. If you're practicing mindfulness, the rage is just a feeling. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to identify with it or connect with it. It can just be there.
Well, and one of the things that that Dr. Anderson said in her postscript was this idea of we push ourselves so hard. And this is just it's a common theme that I hear in TMS literature. You know, we are strivers. We are constantly pushing ourselves. We're trying to achieve things, maybe because we didn't have good bonds with our parents early on because of some traumatic experience. Perhaps they did some violence to us. Perhaps something else happened, and to survive, we had to push ourselves to internalize everything. When we had an emotion, we invoked the freeze response instead of fighting or fleeing, just to survive. And we push ourselves so hard, but you know, maybe we can learn to tolerate that emotion. That's the affect tolerance idea, which I think to me is kind of the core of this kind of New York Dr. Sarno approach. This is what the Sarno psychologists seem to be telling us, is learn to tolerate and have a respectful relationship with your emotions. And
that really works for me, Forrest. I think you put it very well, and Bruce has backed you up too. I know for myself, my first, 12, 13 years, something like that, I was mostly really sad all the time. And then I became a teenager and I got, I had entirely too much fun for a while. And then when I couldn't do that anymore, I got mad. I got really rageful. And that went on, decade after decade after decade. And basically what I did, I tried to fight it and I said, oh no, you can't feel that way and all that kind of crap. And finally, I just learned to live with it. I didn't act on it necessarily. Sometimes I did act on it. And then finally, it just got so that, I've got some rage. There's no doubt about it. You know, that's part of the human condition. And now in my 60s, I'm moving on to contemplating the philosophy of the whole thing. But it took me that long, going through feeling those emotions, maximizing my ability to accept them, until I could finally think clearly enough so that I can start thinking about, now what does this all mean to me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well,
don't you think? Don't you think that feeling the rage challenges our self-image as a nice person, as a good person, as someone who's being perfect all the time? It creates this huge discontinuity and conflict.
Oh, you're
right. You have to face the rage.
It does do that, exactly. That's how I feel. That's exactly what happens.
Yeah, but you've been constructing this image of yourself as perfect and good as a way to compensate for this underlying anger for a long, long time. In fact, it's at the core of your personality and its development. So when you're challenging... When the rage challenges your self-image, it really creates a huge discontinuity that you have to bridge some way.
And that seems to be...
The thing is, you get used to it. After a while, you realize you're a person who has these emotions. And in fact, you quickly realize that everybody has these emotions at times. And to repress them is far worse than to realize that you're not Miss Perfect or Mr. Perfect or whatever you had whatever your ambition was as a child, you know, to turn into somebody who never annoys anybody and never does anything wrong and never deserves criticism and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's part of, you know, life is all about growing up. And that's, I think, what Pathways is saying. It's all about growing up.
Yeah. One thing which I got from the masterclass in New York, where I got to hear Dr. Sherman and Dr. Anderson speak, is it's not just about what's happening to you, and it's not just about how you feel about what's happening to you. It's about how you feel about how you feel about what's happening to you. That if you can achieve peace about the fact that you have the rage, then that is what's healing. You know, that is... that is what we all need to do, to recognize that the rage is a private internal experience, and that ambivalence is okay, that it's okay to love and hate at the same time, that it's human nature, in fact, to love and hate at the same time, is, I think that's where the real healing comes. That's I think, what we are capable of doing.
You're bridging the gap in the divided mind.
Mm-hmm. There you go. You don't need to divide the mind. Yeah.
Yeah, between the paleo-mammalian child mind with its instincts, the id, and the superego and the ego in the prefrontal cortex, they aren't really in conflict. They really complement each other.
Yeah.
As much as you try and divide it, when you act like Miss Prim or Little Lord Fauntleroy, you're just evading something that's natural, that's part of our nature, part of human nature.
Yeah, you're right. I'm listening.
At this stage of our evolution, anyway, as Dr. Sarno would say,
indeed.
We haven't our brain hasn't advanced enough yet.
Yeah, and I hear it's so interesting to hear your voice, Lynn, because I hear that tension. And I suspect, I mean, it's interesting to watch different people and how different people progress at different speeds and different things happen in their development as we watch them on the forum or in the drop-in chat or on this call-in discussion group. And my hunch is, not like I really know, but my hunch is that, you know, maybe these emotions are going to be around with you for a little while. And that, or, you know, for a long while even. But that if you can do what Enjoy was talking about, I think that'll serve you very well. And, you know, to enjoy taking the walk for taking the walk.
I think that's so true. The thing is that maybe someday we'll get past that. We'll be so mature that we're not going to have all this rage. I know that I'm not nearly as angry at my parents as I was. Most of it has dissipated. But, boy, people, I remember, I mean, I used to go sometimes to groups where you'd, you know, talk about your inner child and all that kind of stuff. And when I started to talk about my parents, I was so angry, and I would try not to spit rage, but it didn't matter. It still leaked, and people knew what I was saying, and I would have so-called facilitators and therapists turn to me and say, well, you don't have to take it that seriously. You know, and I heard that happening, and I couldn't believe it. And everybody thought I should just chill. And I hadn't even expressed 1% of what I was feeling. I just, you know, I just have a tendency to speak fairly strongly at the best of times. So I went home and I thought to myself, okay, what do I do? You know, do I kill myself or something because I'm not good enough in these people's eyes? And then I thought, no, I can't do that. I am angry. It doesn't matter whether it's justified or not. I'm not the judge. I don't know if it's justified. I just know it's there. I know it's there. You know, so I started to, like you say, live with it. And very, very important what you said, Forrest, I think, to live life in spite of it. Not to go for a walk because you're in a rage. Go for a walk and enjoy the walk. Mm-hmm. Enjoy the walk. Let the rage be. I mean, just it's part of you.
One thing that is, so what you just said reminded me of something that Alan Gordon says a lot. He talks about how fear is addictive and how anger is addictive. And it is. It wants to suck you in. It wants to change the channel to get you to be thinking about why hasn't it gone away? Why hasn't it gone away? And that's kind of the distraction strategy at work is to focus you all the time on the emotion and then to change the channel and say, it's here, you know, but so is life. And I'm going to enjoy life.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
That's good. I think it's like I noticed when I was out walking a month ago and I was hurting, having sciatica and lower back pain. I just made my mind pay attention to putting one foot ahead of the other and the path that was unfolding before me. And pretty soon the pain became irrelevant. I wasn't feeling it anymore. Because I was just dealing with the here and now as it is.
Without
entering into that dialogue between the inner and the inner and outer aspects of the brain. I was just engaged in an activity as its own end.
No, that's not a problem with me. I'm very physically active, and I've never stopped being physically active as a result of all the pain. I just work through it. I work out at a gym every day for about 2.5 hours, and I've done it from the time I was even very sick. Hello?
Yep, we're all here.
Yeah, we're here.
I just hear, I think I have a call waiting, but I'm not doing anything about it. So that, I work through the physical pain, and I don't let that stop me from doing anything. But emotionally, when I get really depressed, that's what stops me from, and I am very depressed. It's not the physical pain that stops me, because I keep going. It's the emotion, it's the depression that comes along with it.
It takes a lot of refocusing. I'm really glad that you called in, because you've kind of been joining us throughout this this series of podcasts, and I think you just need reassurance and reminders, as we all need periodically, to keep on focusing on, you know, the good parts of our life, and to find the peace and equanimity to manage our emotions. So thank you for that. In terms of going around the circle, it's my job to kind of keep things moving. Enjoy. Did you want to comment a little bit on what you've gotten out of this?
Well, I just wanted to say something to the lady who called last. I'm sorry, I don't know what your name was. I missed
Lynn.
That. That was Lynn? Okay. Hi, Lynn. Talking about depression, and I don't know, this may be no use to you at all, but I used to have an awful time with depression, and one day it occurred to me, I'm sick of this. I'm just not going to do it. When I'm depressed, I'm going to do something I never, ever do, and that was lie in bed, watch soap operas and eat chocolates. And I started doing that, and it was within a matter of a few months, a lifetime pattern of a lot of depression completely disappeared. And I'm not suggesting my particular cure, but whatever makes you happy that isn't driven, that's the exact opposite of what you usually do. Because I would never do that. I always had to be up, I always had to be busy, I always had to be improving. You know, and this way I just thought, the heck with it. And literally, within a few months, I was no longer depressed. And actually, it became a huge problem, because it turned out that I was depressed when I was exhausted. Right? And exhaustion, like depression, would give me a chance to slow down a bit. So since I was every time I felt depressed, I would just completely quit and go have, you know, just a nice day off for myself. I stopped being depressed, and I stopped having that rest. So I got to the stage where I had to think to myself, oh my gosh, I'm just absolutely pooped, and I'm not depressed. What am I going to do? And so then I stayed home and watched soap operas for the afternoon. Just
good for you.
I had to cut back on the chocolates eventually. But I'm just saying, like, to me, it's been very, very important to figure out what I like doing and do more of it for myself when I'm feeling down, and particularly when I'm feeling down. Yeah.
Bravo. Well, and that seems to be like the one of the other main themes of Pathways, is developing the ability to attend and be aware of your own emotions, and then figuring out what you need to do to manage those emotions. So becoming aware that you're tired, and recognizing that, well, when I'm tired, you know, it feels good to watch soap operas.
And the thing is, if I don't stop and do, or just, you know, read mysteries or do whatever the heck it is that you don't ordinarily let yourself do, you know, enough of. And if you don't do that, like for me, if I don't do that, that's when I get depressed. Now, I only get depressed, that kind of depression almost never happens. And it used to be a significant part of my life. So it worked for me.
And it seems like the soap operas are also great because they're so engrossing and they grab your attention and they're very stimulating. So I know if I'm put in front of a TV with a show, as long as it's not, you know, if it's something that does grab me, then it's great at kind of changing the channel.
Exactly. And the soap operas, they have the added benefit is because I was very ambitious. I was raised to be ambitious. But it turned out I didn't actually want to do all of that stuff. And so it took me a long, long time to realize I don't want to do this, you know. But anyway, meantime, I was depressed a lot of the time because I'm not making any progress towards these grand ambitions. And one of the things that the reason why soap operas work so well for me is here's all these people and they were all big shots and they all lived in big houses and I was so glad I wasn't one of them. I was so glad. It was really funny.
I watched The Maker, but I'm not a soap opera person, but I do escape by watching movies. I go to the library and I get movies on DVD and I watch movies and when they grab me I feel better. And I guess my depression stems from when I always worked and I had a purpose, I felt like I had a purpose in life, I wasn't depressed. When I had something to do with a goal that I felt like I was making an impact or a change in the world, I didn't feel depressed. And right now I don't have any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel...
You probably need to do the exact opposite. Find something that you can do in those times when you're not feeling useful. You know, because, I mean, everybody's different, and what depresses us is different. And it's a matter of fooling around and finding what works for you.
All right, now, finding...
It just so hard. What you're saying just seems to sound so much like how we're all living in a legacy left over from the Victorians, you know, late 19th century social utilitarianism, where you always have to be doing something that's making things better. You can't just enjoy yourself without this rationalization.
Yeah.
That it's earth-shaking, it's somehow earth-shaking, or it's part of some personal myth of self-improvement.
To juxtapose against that, if I can read something by Dr. Anderson. Oh, it's good to have a good thing. We all want to talk. It's wonderful. Anyway, okay. I'm going to read something by Dr. Anderson, which I think speaks to what Bruce was just talking about. Feelings of safety, pleasure, joy, and love help us bond with others, providing support to move forward in life and handle the internal and external pleasure. So these are the soothing activities like the soap operas or the movies or having a project.
So there you go. They're useful.
Yeah. Me, the peer network, the TMS Wiki is my project, which just feeds my soul. Too often, the same people who suppressed anger and fear because of these traumatic experiences early in life did not feel secure bonds with the power figures around them. The six patients whose treatment I described here in Pathways had survived by learning to please others in order to secure a sense of safety and of self-esteem. Along with pleasing others, they learned, in varying degrees, to press themselves for performance in their job and whatever they're doing at the highest levels in all areas. And I hear echoes in what Lynn is saying, in what Enjoy is saying, in my own experience. I'm sure, Bruce, I know you're the same way. I described how this kind of self-induced pressure had contributed to considerable anger deposited in the reservoir of rage.
Right.
I thought that was
just
a great paragraph.
I feel angry about that. I feel very I feel happy about my careers. I've had three of them, and I feel really good about that. But now I feel like I don't have a direction in life, and that's what's making me depressed because I don't have a I cook, I do needlepoint, I create, I garden, I do lots of things to make me happy. But that doesn't really, it's not the same. It's not.
You need a mission.
Yeah, you need a mission.
Yeah.
It's
great.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been looking for, and I haven't found what that is at the current stage of my life.
You can help us start a nonprofit.
I certainly noticed a lot of what you're talking about came true for me when my parents died and I was in a position to retire.
But I'm not. I mean, my parents died and I have a little bit of money, but I can't be retired. And my therapist keeps telling me, go and find a job. And I keep saying, I guess my motivation for not wanting to go out and find a job is that I have a little bit of money, but I'm Obama killed it because I'm at the point where I have to pay for everything and I'm jealous because all my friends whittled away their money and they have nothing, so the government pays for everything. And I'm at the point where I have to pay for everything, and if I go get a job, every dollar that I make goes, for every $2 I make, $1 goes back to the government. So why go get a job when I don't even get to keep any of it?
Well, okay, that could take us, I'm afraid, very far afield.
No, that's what I'm angry about.
You don't have Medicare then?
Oh, Bruce, we're not going to go there. We can't go there because there are people listening, and we don't want to get off topic. But let's. One thing which I found very interesting in what you said at the very beginning, Bruce, was about the idea of fully experiencing your emotions.
Yes.
And I kind of wanted to question you about that. So there are some people who read Dr. Sarno's books, and they say that if I'm repressing rage, what I need to do is I need to learn to fully experience the emotions. I need to go deep into my anger at for example, Obama's policies to the people who have hurt me in the past, and I need to just get angry, and I need to beat up a pillow, and I just need to do that. Now, that's actually, I have a different approach to that. I feel like what we need to do is we need to show some respect for our feelings, and we need to know when we're feeling them. We need to feel the anger. Maybe we need to look and explore the anger, get to know it a little bit better, know what causes it, etc. But we don't have to amplify it. We just live with it. We tolerate it. We have that affect tolerance. But we allow it. We don't suppress it. We bring it out and become more aware of it so that we're not stuffing it. We're not doing that freeze reaction. But we're also not revving ourselves up. Does that make sense to you? Like, what are your thoughts on that, Bruce?
Well, I agree. You don't need to rev yourself up. You don't. You need to let the emotion be, the emotion of rage. Although I can see some virtue in instantaneous short-term dynamic psychotherapy of feeling that emotion in depth. I've noticed if you work through the whole process from feeling rage to feeling shame and guilt to feeling compassion, you actually, and even to tears, afterwards the pain goes away. You have dissipated it when you've directly experienced it, pulled it up out of the dregs of your mind and then dealt with it.
Wait for a couple of days and then it comes back. I'm fine.
Then express it again and go through the cycle again. you know. I mean, to me, life is all about balance, isn't it? I mean, there were times when I had to express the rage, but now, well, as I'm getting older, I'm finding that fewer and fewer of those times occur, and more times are like Forrest. Now, Forrest, you seem like a very mellow fellow to me, and I hope someday I'll get to be like Forrest. But I'm a very volatile person. Right, and I yell and scream and throw things and can act quite misbehave. But once, like it's like Bruce says, you go through that, you feel ashamed of yourself. You think, well, that was overdoing it. You say, come on, calm down. You're not mad at yourself. You don't beat yourself up over it because it's an honest emotion. But then you settle down. You let it be. Yes, I'm angry, but you don't have to display it. You don't have to make it a big part of your life. You just, it's balance.
Yeah. Yeah. Go for it, Bruce.
I had a question for you, Forrest. Sort of a literary question. What do you make of the role of dogs as they move throughout these stories? Why is the rage always located in one of our four-legged friends, the boxer with the eviscerated stomach, the family dog being subjected to a cannibal feast that gets Mr. A to say, in the dream, it's like the dog was sweating tears. I was always trying to take it. Speaking about his role in the family with his older brother bullying him. Why is it dogs? I was thinking about the Egyptian gods, where they always had a combination of human and animal characteristics. I think they call that miscegenation. Are the animals, like the rabbit, the carnivorous rabbit and the and the boxers and the boxer that defecates all of the dead turkeys with the rats inside of them and then the cannibal dog, is it that these emotions, these unacceptable or unbearable emotions are transferred onto these our four-legged friends because we can't transfer it onto ourselves directly. They serve as intermediaries.
Well, maybe
like
they're
the Egyptian gods, you know.
Maybe they are, animals you can relate to them emotionally. You care about them. You can experience love for them. But at the same time, they're so different as to be safe. So it's if you're going to be putting... you know that those aren't your emotions if they are in a dog or in a bunny, as opposed to in a person or in your brother. Another possibility just comes to mind is I know Dr. Anderson in the preface she talks about. I think she dedicates it to her cats. And I think also she talks a lot about the role of the therapist and how the therapist uses their own emotions to kind of understand and their own reactions, sometimes their own physical reactions to understand the patient. She also talks about how these stories, her writing process was very collaborative. It was in between the therapist and the patient. One of her books is called Relational Perspectives on the Body, and she lists herself as a relational psychoanalyst. My understanding of relational psychoanalysis is that it's very postmodern, and in postmodern thinking in general, they tend to blur the distinction between the observer and the observed. So maybe there's just a little bit of interaction between her as observer and the object of the observation, and possibly as the therapist, what she's able to pick up on, the symbolism that she's able to see and that affects her most powerfully, maybe is that symbolism having to do with animals because she loves animals herself. So that's where she kind of pulls it out of these of these long sessions. But I
mean,
I could.
That Forrest is that. I mean, obviously, we're getting the tiniest glimpse of what went on with these folks because they were in therapy for 8 or 9 years, some of them.
Yeah.
So this would be something that Dr. Anderson could really relate to, and use to make her points. But I think it's important. I mean, animals are important to us. I mean, they are us without all the thinking, you know. So we can feel through our animals, I think.
But in terms of how important they are, okay, so I'm a little bit of an internet guy. For the nonprofit, I have to be. But look at the popularity and the virality of cat pictures or cat videos. They are huge because cats are important. Animals are important to us. They're like babies.
I was just thinking that the transference of emotions onto symbolic animals is the result of what Dr. Anderson calls affect intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shift. It's a transposition that occurs because you can't face the rage directly.
Definitely. I agree.
Yeah, very useful.
Very useful. So, okay, so it's been the co-host speaking, and we've had Lynn jump in. Does anyone else have any questions or any thoughts about what we've discussed? You know, whether you've read the book or not, I don't care, but if you just have something you want to share or ask about, get our thoughts on.
I have not. It's not about the book, but I looked on the website and I saw that there was a webinar with last Thursday with I forget the names of the doctors now. Dr. Schumacher.
Schumacher.
Somebody else. And I was wondering how to access that.
Oh so, my goodness, I have no idea. But send me an email about it, forest@tmswiki.org, and I'll figure it out for you.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on the book or on the discussion that we've been having that people want to weigh in on?
I think it's interesting that Dr. Anderson reaches the conclusion in the book, Pathways, that if affect intolerance is not seen as the culprit, the driving force behind TMS, the therapeutic goals shift from cure to helping the patient cope with pain, the whole pain management center concept where people are constantly being dosed with various drugs as if pain is a disease in its own right. It's a semantic shift that's occurred because of people not looking at the psychological reasons behind the development of chronic pain. It's a semantic shift, but it's turned into a clinical problem in the whole pain management game. I know she ends her book with that observation, and I think it's very important.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. It's bad medicine because it's treating the symptom rather than the cause.
And how many people are dying every year from misprescriptions of pain medicine? And if they're drinking at the same time, it destroys their liver. It just goes down this... dark path.
I won't take any medicines. I've people have tried to prescribe them. I won't take anything. I don't believe in that because I think the medicine shield. I mean, they're placebos or whatever.
Yeah, it's like the doctor says, "Oh, you heard? Here, take this." You know, we won't deal with the problem. Cover it up.
Everybody wants to shove your pills and go away. And I won't do it. I just refuse to do it.
Well, that's another complex question. And since we only have 8 minutes left, or a little bit less than 8 minutes, I'm going to take, I said at the beginning that we were going to go around the circle. And so we started out with Bruce, and then we talked a little bit about Enjoy. Does anyone mind if I kind of take a couple minutes for some of my own thoughts? I just kind of wanted to share kind of my personal journey of reading the book and some of the connections that I've drawn.
Go for us.
Okay.
Thank you. they're not. Most of the themes I think have already been covered. I thought you guys did a great job of drawing those out. But for me, I think that my experience of the book has been colored by reading some brain physiology, some brain science at the same time. And I think that's probably not surprising, as I know that Dr. Anderson mentions in some of the earlier chapters that she is a fan of a new field. She doesn't say this explicitly. This is just my reading of it. She just mentions a number of authors, some of them psychoanalysts, who are interested in brain science as well. This may be related to a field which has been created in the last decade or so called neuropsychoanalysis, combining neurology or neuroscience and psychoanalysis in the same place. So when I read this, I'm reading The Emotional Brain by Joseph Ledoux. I've kind of come up with an idea of it's almost, I think I'm most comfortable, as perhaps many people with TMS, in my rational brain, in my what would be called the frontal cortex or the prefrontal cortex, in the conscious parts of the brain. But I've learned that there's this other part of the brain as well. Some people might call it the limbic system. Some people might call it the paleo mammalian brain. Those words have different meanings, but you could use them in the same manner, because I don't want to get bogged down in those terms. I kind of made up my own term for it. I call it the OSU brain. OSU is an acronym. I hope this doesn't sound too silly. O stands for older. It's an older part of the brain, the brain that we might have in common with the animals that we can relate to that Bruce was talking about. That might be the foundation on which we can relate to them. I think Jak Panksepp talks a lot about that. The S stands for somatic. We can understand this part of the brain through our bodies. We can pay attention to what's happening in our bodies to learn what's happening in this paleomammalian or limbic system or OSU brain. Just as earlier on we were talking with Lynn and how I suggested that she could talk about how she was feeling it in her body, and in fact her psychologist had suggested the same thing. What makes this challenging, of course, is the final letter, the E, is that it's the emotional brain. But what makes it challenging is that these emotions in this older somatic part of the brain are often unconscious, and that's the U, O-S-U-E, this unconscious part of the brain. And I guess for me that was just kind of an interesting twist, which helped me better understand this book. For me personally, is what we need to do is we need to develop more of an awareness, more of an understanding, and more of a tolerance for what's going on in our OSU brain, for lack of a better term, so that, because it is, it may be unconscious, we may have to start by understanding it through our bodies, and we may, as in that paragraph I read earlier, we may have been so scared early on that we suppressed these emotions in kind of a freeze reaction, but we need to kind of reclaim that territory, redevelop awareness of what's going on in that part of our brain, and kind of a respectful relationship with that part of the brain, where we know a little bit how to soothe it, and we know how to live with it if we can't soothe it, and we become scientists, where we know better what's going on and how to manage it to the extent that we can. So that's that was just my little two cents that I wanted to add.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Wow, thank you. Is this your acronym? Is this your word, OSU?
Yeah, I made it up.
I
would use the name Paleo Mammalian Brain, but Paleo Mammalian is making too strong of a claim. And so I just wanted a more neutral term.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, that was very interesting.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to read the book again because, you know, I enjoyed the stories and everything, but I didn't get these themes. It's many times I've had to listen to the podcast to get the themes. So I'll go back through it and try it again. Sometimes I have to do that. You know, when it's particularly useful when somebody's brain works a little different than yours does, and not to give up and to try again. So I'm going to do that.
Seems like so many TMS books, you really profit from reading them multiple times. You know, you get the basic ideas early on, and then but it's in the later readings where you learn to apply them to yourself and you see the big picture.
That's right.
I'm looking forward to reading it too.
Or you don't get the basic ideas in the beginning and read them again to get those.
I'm beginning to learn that. I've read everything once and now I'm twice, and twice as it's beginning to sink in a better. Hello?
Yeah.
And I'm still working on Waking the Tiger, so I have a while to go. That's a big book. So I'm working on that right now. So it'll be a while before I get to this book.
Excellent. Excellent. It looks like there'll probably be a paperback version for those who hadn't heard that yet. Anyway, we are in our final moment. We're going to have to go and join the chat room. I'm going to see if I can start the main chat room back up, but that'll be it for this week. We are changing our schedule. We are now going to start meeting on Tuesdays just to round out the schedule. And on Monday, this hasn't been announced publicly. I guess I talked about it last week. We had some technical issues, so we were hoping to release it last Monday, but it looks like the Alan Gordon Recovery Program is now slated to be released this Monday, and so hopefully I was thinking that maybe on Tuesday we could start talking about that, because that will very much be the topic of the day, and I'm sure people will be interested. But after that, maybe we can talk a little bit about where we want, what we want to do next, and what people are interested in hearing about.
Excellent.
What time on Tuesday?
9 o'clock Eastern Time, 6 o'clock Pacific.
9 o'clock in the morning?
PM, after work.
I was just thinking, yay, it worked for Pacific for once, and then that kind of got blown out of the water there. So not 9 a.m., 9 p.m., right?
And I might have said it wrong. It's 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Yeah.
Wonderful. Perfect.
Nice. Well,
and so Alan Gordon's program is going to be available online at the forum.
Yes, indeed. He has very generously donated the text of it to the wiki. He may update it as we go, but he wants people to be able to do it, and we're going to kind of integrate it tightly with the forum. I'm hoping to put a post up today, but oh gosh, it's tiring working on all this. We're going to try and integrate it with the forum. It should be quite very, very cool. I'm looking forward to it.
It will be.
Yeah.
Thank you, Forrest.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining.
I'll go over to the forum myself. I'm slated to be a moderator.
Ah, yes, so we better let you go. Okay.
Great to meet you, Lynn.
Goodbye.
All right, thanks for joining us all.
Thank you, everybody.
You guys make it worth doing. All right, bye, all.